Welcome to Tech Talk by LG. My name is Erik Svalberg and I'm product specialist here at LG Electronics Nordic. I'm fascinated by tech and I enjoy learning about how things work. So this is a podcast where we get to do exactly that. It's about all things tech and we break down different topics and technologies so that you can also gain a deeper understanding of your favorite products and all of the gadgetry around you every day. Welcome to today's episode, and if you are listening to this, I'm willing to bet this isn't the only type of media that you stream. If it is, I am very flattered, but I'm willing to guess that you stream other things as well. Movies, series, all manner of media. And this is, if you think of it in a larger perspective, a pretty recent development. And if, like me, you're anywhere close to the TV industry, you might have noticed that while a lot of the terminology and principles of TVs are still very much aligned with old school broadcast TV, a lot of the new development is very much focused on turning the television into a streaming device rather than a broadcast receiving device. But this development is affecting so much more than how we design our televisions. From how we produce our content to how we're served new movies and series. Today's episode is about the technology behind streaming and what it's doing to the entertainment around us. So let's start by talking about what these two things are, broadcast and streaming, and what's different about them. Well, broadcast, that really starts off with radio. You started out sending radio waves with audio, and then we started sending out pictures using radio waves. As time went by, this progressed, and we added things like cable TV to the mix. Analog signals became digital. But the thing about broadcast is that it's always a constant feed. You knew that a person had to continue watching for a certain period of time in order to finish watching a series or a movie. And for this reason, you could add commercial breaks. And since the feed was constant, you also had things like prime time. You knew that at certain hours, more people would be willing to watch television, and you would program certain shows on your channel that would align with what generally people wanted to watch at that hour. For example, for me growing up in Sweden, I knew that at 9 o'clock was when every channel would put on a movie, and family-friendly game shows, things like that, would come on right before then, because then you would know that it was over before you had to put the kids to bed. But then with the advent of streaming services with video on demand, all of that kind of went out the window. First of all, you don't have to adhere to an hour anymore. You can watch whatever you want, whenever you want. Another thing is that the content providers don't really have to worry about gathering everybody in front of the television at the same time. So they can offer some content that might not interest everybody and that you might consider a bit more niched. But at the same time, they know that if you take every viewer who would potentially want to watch that show over, let's say, the span of a month and let them spread out over every hour of the day, you can still gather a pretty good audience for that niche show anyway. But typically, it also changes the climate around advertising, because if you think about the bigger streaming services for cinema and series, these are services that offer you video on demand. Video on demand traditionally doesn't include any commercial breaks. And this was already established with video on demand over regular cable TV. For the younger generation, I'm sure they will listen to what regular broadcast television was and just think, how could we possibly spend our time watching things that we didn't choose to watch and then also watch commercial breaks in between those things that we didn't really choose to watch? It all sounds insane for a modern generation. But the thing is, we obviously needed to cross a couple of hurdles before we could get to the point of video on demand streaming as we have today. And the most obvious one is, of course, bandwidth. Just as radio waves were the first important component for regular linear TV to become a thing in the beginning, internet connections were the base component for all sorts of streaming. And before a regular household could count on having a good enough internet connection, streaming just wasn't going to be a thing. But fortunately, technology caught up, and now we actually have more than 91% of the Nordic population with access to an internet connection. But what else did we need? Well, let's talk a bit about how the stream is actually brought to you. Just like other data, audio and video data is broken down into data packets. Each packet contains a small piece of the file, and that could be audio or a video that's being played. And the video player in the browser or on the client that is receiving this information takes this flow of data packages and interprets them putting them together into a video or an audio. And there's two different methods for sending these packages. Now, one of them is called TCP. It opens up a dedicated connection between the device that is receiving the data and the device that's transmitting the data. And this dedicated connection also includes a handshake, as it's called. This means that it checks and confirms that each package is delivered, and this, of course, makes the transfer speed a bit slower. Now, UDP is another method, and it just sends the packages fast. Now, some packages can get lost and it can have some security issues, but it's going to transfer the information a lot faster because it's just a constant stream. You could compare this to a delivery service. Now, maybe you're getting, let's say, one package every day and one of the delivery services is offering to just leave it outside of your door. It's going to be a lot faster. You don't even have to be there. But the other delivery service offers to deliver it to you personally, make sure that you sign for the package, and that way you're going to be a lot more secure that the package got there. And these two basic methods of delivering information packages are preferred for different tasks. Like, let's say, if you have an ongoing video call, it might not be a big deal if you have a bit of distortions as long as you're still able to follow the conversation. But if there's a 2-second delay in the dialogue, there's going to be a very big mismatch, and you might start talking at the same time as somebody else starts talking, and then you'll have 2 seconds of overlap before you realize that you're both talking, and then it all becomes a mess. Because that same delay sticks around while you're both sitting there saying, no, you go ahead. No, no, you, I'll wait for you. I'll wait. It's okay, I'll go. No, okay, yes, you can go. Now, if you've ever been in one of those calls, you tell me how well that went. So in a case like this, you might want to use a UDP connection. But if you're going to watch a movie, you want quality picture, you want quality sound, you want immersion, you want a really good experience, then TCP might be something you prefer because you can buffer up the data packages, you make sure all of the data packages arrive and in order and are correctly delivered without any distortions. And that way, sure, the connection might be a bit slower, but at the same time, if the entire movie is lagging behind 2-3 seconds, you're not going to notice because the whole movie is still progressing in a steady flow, and that's fine. That speed is really only needed if it's an interactive medium. But that's also why it might be preferred for some live streaming events, for example. You might want to have a UDP connection if you are live streaming and you have a live chat and you have people engaging with you in real time. So both of these methods are widely used in streaming. And this brings us to another change that streaming has brought to the media landscape and to how media is consumed, because we still have live broadcasts, we just call them live streams, and the difference is that these are now typically reserved not for movies, not for pre-recorded content, but for interactive content. So it's people like YouTubers and live streamers, Twitch stars, who will do something online or maybe just talk to the camera, engaging with their fans, engaging with their followers, discussing different topics. And if we look at the top 10 video streaming apps right now globally, Netflix does come in first, but there's a couple of others that aren't far behind, and YouTube, for instance, comes in second. And while Netflix offers, in a more traditional sense, cinema, series, documentaries from big studios, YouTube, on the other hand, features a lot of independent creators. And with this comes a comment section, where viewers actively engage and interact with the people that they are watching. And this becomes a very interesting development in just how we consume content, because a lot of the content being consumed nowadays is also content that we can interact with. And there are active discussions below every video. And this is, again, one of those areas where traditional broadcast TV doesn't offer the same opportunities. But in the end, for these platforms to exist, there have to be companies running them. And for the companies to exist, there needs to be a way to monetize these services. So where does that leave us? Well, platforms like YouTube and many of these short-form video platforms, as well as far as I know, all of the live streaming platforms like Twitch and so on, will offer different advertising possibilities and will place ads before videos or in videos or as little inlays in the image. But the streaming platforms that focus more on long-form content, movies, series, like for instance, Prime or Netflix or Disney, They need you to feel that their platform is the one worth subscribing to, or one of the services worth subscribing to. So just as back in the days with broadcast television, it is a war for your attention, for your attention span. And just as in any battle, the difference is that the weapons have changed. And in this case, we have algorithms, AI, and we have data, a lot of data. And this is really where we see the biggest evolution as well in how to promote a service. Because traditionally, you would try to make a show that people would want to watch, and then you would try to make people want to watch it through copious amounts of advertising. And don't get me wrong, this is still done. But what you can do now is also tailor who gets to see the ads. And you can do this within the same platform by watching, for instance, what other shows have you viewed? Which other shows did you rate highly? And I mean, this is no secret. We participate gladly because it also gives us a more personalized offering of recommendations. And it's easier for us to find the type of content that we want to watch. I mean, if you think of it from that perspective, it really is a win-win. Things are becoming more data-driven, more algorithmic, and this is also seen when the content producers are actually the streaming platforms themselves, because they can also then tailor the content they create to the content that they know will be consumed. And sure, you could argue that this becomes a much more seductive platform and you end up watching a lot more than you would have watched otherwise, but hopefully it also means you got a better platform and better content out of it. And this comes down to quality as well, because if you think about it, back in the day, you used to go to the cinema knowing that you would never be able to see that picture, experience that movie in that way anywhere outside of a movie theater. And that was one of the big draws of going to the theater. Your standard definition carried around 345,000 pixels in a picture. That's the amount of detail you could get in your regular television broadcast. Compare that to our modern 4K streaming services that deliver 8.3 million pixels per image in a UHD resolution. If we're just talking about detail, that's practically the equivalent of watching a movie in the cinema, because the traditional 35mm film only had a marginally higher detail than regular 4K resolution. And of course, the technology available to us at home has changed. So nowadays, for instance, if you have a high quality television, you'll have access to Dolby Vision and Dolby Atmos. And those are formats that not even your average cinema theater will carry, because they're only available in Dolby cinema theaters. So if you have access to that and your streaming services are able to provide those formats, you're actually getting some level of quality that you're not even getting from the cinema theater. And of course, also your average television has become better and bigger. Now, since I'm in Sweden, I'm going to use Swedish numbers as reference, but across the Nordics, the numbers are roughly the same. So let's look at the access that people have to these services. In a study from 2021, we could see that out of the full population, 95% had access to televisions, but 75% had smart TVs. And let's keep in mind that out of those last 20%, you might have people using a Chromecast or an Apple TV box or some other additional device, letting them stream to the television as well, which means that pretty much the entire population is able to use these services now. Perhaps then it's no surprise that from 2021 to 2022, the average number of subscription-based video on demand services that a person had access to went up from 2.9 to 3.2 per person. And this is without a doubt also something that is influenced by the fact that the platforms themselves have become major content producers. For example, Netflix has produced 1,500 titles since it started producing original content in 2013. And 89% of the content provided by Disney Plus is exclusive to the platform. And this is where that algorithmically induced binge watching comes in, because obviously platforms need to justify the subscription, and if you're not watching, why would you pay? So they need to make sure that the content you want to watch is only on their platform, and they want to make sure that you still want to watch it and want to keep watching it. So really, the big loser in the fight is the video home section, because who's going to buy a Blu-ray movie when you can stream the movie at a better quality And the only exception, of course, being 4K Blu-rays, and how many of us really own a 4K Blu-ray player? But another place where that change has been felt has, of course, been Hollywood, because the video home section used to be a big source of revenue for them, and traditional TV used to be another. In the US, in 2010, 46% of a movie's total revenue came from video and DVD sales. 28% came from television licensing. Only 26 actually came from the box office. 2020, video and DVD sales make up only 36% of the total revenue, 18% TV licensing, and 46% of the total revenue that a movie has to make is all gonna need to come from the box office. And this is obviously creating a lot of pressure for film studios at the same time as film budgets are only getting larger and larger. And it's not like the theaters are prospering too much either. Let's use an example from the biggest cinema chain I can think of, AMC Theaters in the US. They grossed $5.47 billion in 2019. But if you look at their numbers from 2021, they were down to $2.53 billion. So that's a pretty big decrease. Meanwhile, if you look at the revenue of Disney Plus, in their first year of operation, which coincidentally was also 2019, they had a $2.6 billion revenue. But by 2021, they had done the inverse and they were now up at $5.2 billion of revenue. And of course, it's no secret that the pandemic played in a lot into our streaming habits. For instance, here in Sweden, we saw an average increase of 1 hour per day per person in how much streaming content we consumed. And when you look at it this way, why wouldn't we stream more? The quality's getting better. You get to watch whatever you want, whenever you want. You're getting the resolution of a cinema and the formats of a Hollywood studio, and some screens today are so ridiculously good it feels like you're there in real life. If you got a strong enough picture processor in your TV, it's also going to compensate for, you know, any potential compression or things that might affect the picture content. So it sounds like streaming is basically all pros and no cons. You got no plastic boxes and discs, no Blu-ray players, so that's a lot of extra clutter away from your shelf. You're not driving to the store, you're not driving down to the movie theater. You've got on-demand entertainment, and it feels like it's really got no physical impact on the world, right? Well, let's look at the actual costs of streaming. In 2021, The Verge reported that Netflix had 17,000 servers spread out across 158 countries and plans to continue expanding its content delivery network. But Netflix also relies heavily on Amazon Web Services. For major tech service providers in a market that is practically aiming to reach every corner of the world, building your entire infrastructure from scratch, you need everything from cloud storage and cloud computing, data collection, and of course not least, content delivery. That could be an absolutely insurmountable task. And that's where Amazon Web Services comes in. Amazon Web Services consists of over 200 products and services and provides a lot of, if not all, the network infrastructure for services like Netflix, Disney+, Hulu, and of course, Prime Video, also owned by Amazon. It's hard to really grasp the size of Amazon Web Services, and it can be a bit tricky to get a precise number to go by, but in December 2014, they had servers across 11 regions and 28 of what they call availability zones. At the time, an Amazon engineer shared an estimate that each availability zone would have 1 to 6 data centers, depending on the population and the amount of users in the area. But every single data center would have a minimum of 50,000 servers. His estimate landed around 1.4 million servers worldwide. And today, Amazon Web Services maintains 77 availability zones. So you do the math. And add to that that Microsoft and Google have additional competing solutions, and as late as November 2022, Disney spent $900 million acquiring the final 15% of BAMTech, which could, as I understand it, provide the same sort of network solutions as Amazon Web Services currently provides for them. So now that we grasp the scale of infrastructure needed to maintain our modern media consumption, we also see that there is one more technological hurdle connected to the streaming market, and that's energy. As TV manufacturers, we of course play a big role in this. We are working to make the life cycle and consumption of TVs more energy efficient, and it's a key component. As a consumer, you can look to things like energy labels, but also ratings from reliable third-party sources like EcoVadis that help you evaluate how sustainable an entire company is. The other part, of course, is a problem shared by basically all of society today, and that's the migration to clean energy. Because some sources estimate that because of the reliance on fossil fuel power sources, the streaming industry today, with everything from the corporations and network infrastructure, content creation, and even the devices you yourself use to receive the stream, could amount to as high as 3-4% of global carbon emissions. But in the meantime, you can actually still rest assured that the streaming model is at least going to have a significantly lighter carbon footprint, and overall, it's more sustainable than all of the other media consumption models that it's replacing. So with this in mind, don't feel bad about relaxing with a good movie, and definitely don't hesitate to like, follow, and subscribe this podcast, whichever is appropriate for the platform you're listening to. And join me for the next Tech Talk in another 2 weeks.